Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carriad Lloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I know MUM Day is looming for those of you in the DMC, so I hope you're doing all right. There has been some amazing advice and support on getting through those tough days on our Twitter, so please do tweet us or just have a look at the feed if you want to know you're not alone in perhaps how you're feeling. We are at The Griefcast on Twitter and on Instagram as well. This week I'm talking to stand-up, writer, radio presenter and podcaster Michelle Laurie. Michelle is Australian and is a very successful lady over there. She's won awards, hosted TV shows, had her own radio show. She sold out the Sydney Opera House for her one-woman show based on her time running a brothel in Melbourne. She also hosts two podcasts, the Nitty Gritty Committee and the Australian True Crime Podcast. And she's written several books, including her latest one, Buddhism for the Unbelievably Busy. Michelle came in to talk to me about her experiences of death whilst working as a palliative care volunteer. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with comedian, writer, podcaster and broadcaster Michelle Laurie, all the way from Australia.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
When did you get in?
A few days ago.
Oh, so you feel okay?
I feel okay. I think I'm pretty good at sleeping on a plane, so I think I'm okay.
Is that like, as an Australian, do you have to be pretty good at sleeping on a plane? Is it like, look, I learned from the age of 10, my parents sent me aside, they locked me in a room for a bit, we pretended it was a plane, I slept for 24 hours.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even to go to other cities is a long time on a plane.
Yeah.
So I've been known to wake up when it's taking off.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've just sat down and got to sleep. So, yeah, I'm a good sleeper.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so got a clear conscience.
So, Michelle, you are a comedian and podcaster, but you also have another side to what you do, which is why you're here at Griefcast. So, would you want to tell us what you do?
Sure. I also volunteer with palliative care.
Right, so how long have you been doing that?
About 4 years.
4 years, wow. And what made you think, I'm going to go and volunteer at this pretty depressing job, let's be honest.
Well, it's not as depressing as it sounds, but it's funny because I, at the time, thought I was just doing it because I like to volunteer.
Right.
I always like to have some volunteering thing going on. Yeah. And I could do this one during the day while my children were at school. I really just thought it's convenient.
Yeah.
Because I was working in a soup kitchen-y kind of vibe before that, and it was always at nighttime.
Yeah.
And that was hard. So I thought, well, this is just daytime.
This will be easier than that soup kitchen.
Yeah,
the soup kitchen hours are tough.
I know. But then later I thought, no, look, if I'm really honest with myself, I've always been drawn to death in some weird way, I think. And there's part of me that likes to walk up to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you experience that in your childhood? Is it something happened? Or?
Well, again, I always think, nah, not really. And, you know, you go to clairvoyance and they go, who can I talk to on the other side? And I go, nah, no one fun. But then I realised that as a small child, both my parents are only children.
Right.
But I was born into a very close family of elderly people.
Yeah.
I would spend my weekends walking around the neighbourhood from house to house to house, from my grandparents to my great-grandmother to great-aunts and uncles.
Wow.
And it was so wonderful.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Every house had its own magical atmosphere. My great-grandmother had this big house, but she only lived in a small area of it. She lived in the kitchen and a little room off the kitchen.
Wow.
Yeah, she'd literally thrown sheets over everything.
Oh, my God.
Like 20 years before I was born.
Miss Havisham style kind of thing. Yeah.
And so we just lived in the kitchen, and every now and then I was allowed to go exploring around the rest of this beautiful big house, but she just had no time for it. She had no interest in it after
not
her husband died. Yeah, she
oh,
just thought,
wow.
I don't need it. She was that kind of person.
Yeah,
I don't need it, so I won't use it. I had an uncle with the most beautiful garden, flowers, snapdragons,
oh, wow.
And just archways that led to other places. And his wife still had a stove that took like wood.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
She
yeah.
cooked, and their hot water came from this stove and
oh,
everything.
Oh, my God.
It was amazing. But then they started dying.
Yeah, they do that. I don't know. There's old relatives.
They do.
It sucks.
When I was 9, they started dying, and they kept dying until I was about 22.
Oh, wow. So, because you had this collection, that generation.
Yeah.
Obviously, they are. By the time you got to 9, they were quite old.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. So, yeah, similar to what happened to me. I had my dad, then my grandpa, then like several great uncles and great aunt. And it just felt like you're going to a funeral every year kind of thing. Yeah. And before that, my grandparents as well, before my dad. So it's just like you get into a slight like, sure, another funeral. Like,
yeah. Well, that's what I wonder now. I think by the end of it, I felt almost impervious.
Mm.
To death. I had some big ones early on. My grandfather was a massive one for me, his death. And then by the end of it, I just felt like I can't be touched by it anymore. It can't hurt me anymore.
Yeah.
So now I don't know if I am impervious to death or if I'm actually avoiding it to the extent that I'm walking up and sort of facing it, but not really.
Because you can go two ways, I think. When you have a lot of death in your childhood, I think some people like don't talk about it at all. You wouldn't know.
Mm.
And then the other way is, I guess, what me and you are doing, which is like, all I do is talk about death and I volunteer and I look after people who are dying.
Yeah.
But in a way, it can be another avoidance because, like you said, you're so close to it. You're almost not dealing with your own grief sometimes. I wonder if that's...
Yeah. And I think I'm trying to prepare myself as well for my own
death
because seeing it up close over and over and over again demystifies those final months, weeks, yeah. days, moments. And I think that most of us are actually more frightened of that period just before death
yeah.
than we are of death. It's potentially humiliating, messy. And so I think I'm trying to just prepare myself for that.
So when you started volunteering, is it a hospice?
No, I go to people's houses.
You go to people's houses as well?
Normally, yeah. In our system in Australia, people stay at home for as long as possible.
Right.
And then go to a palliative care ward at a hospital at the very end. But of course, beds are, precious. Yeah. And some, who knows when there are going to be beds available or not available. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So a lot more people die at home in Australia, would you say?
I think so.
Wow. Yeah. Because it's quite, my mother-in-law and father-in-law died at home, but it was a quite big decision. Like the hospitals were not keen on it. There was a lot of pressure to bring them in because they can look after them better. Mm. And then it had to be, then they have to bring everything over to them. They were supportive of it, but if you're going to die at home, you have to really be, people do obviously
yeah.
die here at home, but it is quite a big deal.
It depends on your circumstances. I think in Australia too, I had a lady who was elderly and living in an aged care place.
Right. Okay.
And she died there. She desperately did not want to die there. Mm. And for months leading up to her death, she asked everyone to promise me I will not die here for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
She'd seen the people wheeled out before. She'd, it becomes this sort of almost gossipy situation where people in the dining hall are talking about so-and-so who got wheeled out and...
Oh, care home sounds like school, guys.
All right. And she was a very proud woman. She hated the care home anyway. And she really loved the palliative care ward at the hospital. Oh. She felt really spoilt there. Yeah. And she liked the food better. She liked everything better. And she tried to get in there as often as she could. And she hoped she'd hang on with her fingernails and hope that she'd be able to stay there until she died. But she didn't.
That's really sad.
It's really sad, yeah, because when the time came, there were no beds. And then very quickly, within sort of 24 hours, she couldn't really be moved again.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? They get to the point where you can't be moved.
Yeah.
So that wherever you are.
But, if you were home alone, I'm sure, they would make sure that you were in the hospital. But it can be difficult if that's where you want to be.
So when you first started volunteering, so you're at people's houses, did you have training?
Yes.
So they give you, how long do you get to look after someone who's dying?
I know. It's a huge responsibility, isn't it? We had one morning a week for 3 months.
Okay.
And it was really good training, though. Not only psychological training, but also they taught us about the last moments of life and how it generally plays out.
Yeah.
It's really interesting how similarly we tend to finish.
And you say that now, and having seen, I guess, quite a few people die, do you feel like it is pretty...
The first time I saw it, I thought, oh, my God, these are the bullet points from that class.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Literally hitting them.
Yeah, literally. From the, what's that awful, existential restlessness is the worst. And I remember just hearing that phrase and thinking, that doesn't sound good.
That's not on my menu.
I don't want that bit. sort of this awful and dysphoria, this feeling of impending doom, which for the first time in your life is actually real.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I've felt dysphoria.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And then you've been able to say to myself,
you're being... Don't be silly. That dress looks fine.
Yeah. It's not ending.
Yeah.
But then one day it is ending and you have that feeling hanging over you and wanting to get up and walk when your body won't walk. That's a thing that happens.
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah.
And then a confusion as your organs break down and toxins enter your brain, and which actually oftentimes looks pretty pleasant to me.
Really?
Yeah.
I think that's it. It obviously depends how you die and what you're dying of. But there are, I've seen a few people now die, and it's awful, but there are moments, as ever as we talk on this show, there are moments that are very peaceful and do look very calm, especially if someone's been ill for a long time.
Yes.
That's the one thing in different cases, but if they've been ill and in pain and they finally look like they're not in pain, that is Mm. I mean, like, as ever, you know, when in life, when you're in pain and you take a paracetamol and suddenly you're like, oh, I feel so much better. Yeah. You see that relief on their faces.
Yeah. And I mean, you have a child. I have children. Mm. Same with them. When you can relieve their pain and see their body relax and see them rest after a painful period of time. Yeah. It's similar to that.
What was your first case?
My first case was very tricky. I mean, initially, after that 3-month training period, then you go out with other people.
Oh, okay. So you're shadowed.
Yes, for a period of time. But the first case that I had to myself was, I thought, wow, you're throwing me in at the deep end. It was a lady my same age.
Oh, God.
With two small children.
See, I was hoping for like a 90-year-old lady.
I know.
She got some cats. Her family really love her. Like, that's what I would want my first case to be.
I know.
Oh, my God. So she was your age with kids. Oh, that's really hard.
And we had a lot in common. We had a shared sense of humour. She was a great, strong, funny, fascinating woman and had these beautiful little babies and had broken up with their dad and sort of didn't want him. So she had this other side going on where she didn't want him to know exactly what was going on because she was scared of him getting the kids.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. So a big thing that I learned during the training process, they try and identify your weaknesses and help you, you know. And a weakness that they identified with me was this desire to problem solve.
Yeah. I think that's quite... I think that's a bit of a comedian thing as well.
Is actually. It?
I don't know. I feel like all the ones I know, maybe it's a female comedian thing.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll fix it.
Yeah.
What do you need? Right, let's do it. Let's sit down. Let's do it.
Sit down and just do it.
Yeah.
And they said to me, you know, you can't, that's not what you're here for. You're not there to.
Yeah, I've been told that.
Really, yeah.
When we had the Julia Samuels, the grief psychotherapist, come on, and she was talking about people's desire to fix things and how you can't do it. And I was like, yeah, but you know, sometimes you want to help them. She was like, yes, but you're not helping. And I could see her looking at me like, what? That's not always helping fixing the problem, but that's taken me, I think I've been trying to, since my mother-in-law and father-in-law passed away, because that's how I dealt with my husband, I tried to fix it. How can we make this better? Even though I had been through it and know you can't do it, the urge to just human to human help someone is really hard to ignore.
Yeah.
So how do we, what did they tell you? What do?
We don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's,
how do I fix my fixing?
It's awful. It's, I just had to keep reminding myself. And again, the bullet points kind of flashed through my mind of the notes that I'd taken in the class, because I wanted to adopt this lady's children.
Yeah,
you know, I wanted to be able to say to her, don't worry.
Yeah,
I've fixed it. I'll have them. You like me. I'm nice.
Yeah.
They're sweet kids. She had an elderly mother.
Oh, God.
Who was going to take... So, yeah, that was really difficult. And she had this interesting coping mechanism where she kept planning things.
Yeah. My dad did that.
Yeah, right.
Right up to the end. Like, he was like... in the hospital going, okay, next week we're going to go, I'm going to go to Chicago or something. I'm going to go to Boston. And me and my mum were like, oh, no, you're not. Yes, I am. We're going to go to Boston. Then we'll go to Scotland, like planning holidays. And I sort of, I think because I was so young, I was like, oh, maybe we will. I don't know. My mum's face is what made me go, oh, I guess we're not going. Because she was just like head in hands, like, what can I do to get through? Yeah. So I guess is that quite common, the planning?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a common way of coping, and I don't think it's a bad thing. No. I wonder, you know, some people are completely at peace. I haven't met any really, but I keep hearing about them.
Yeah.
These people who are ready. But I think, is that necessarily better than just thinking about the future and making plans and drifting off that way?
Yeah.
Surely that's fine, isn't it?
I suppose you're right. There's nothing, like my mum said about my dad, like it just gave him comfort to imagine that, yes, all these things were going to happen. I think it was more painful for her.
Yes.
To be like, they're not going to happen. I have to keep track of that. But yeah, I guess, yeah, why not? If that's how he spent his life. Like, what next? Let's do it. So you can't expect people to immediately change as soon as they find out they're dying.
No. And I've heard about this Chinese custom of not telling people when they're dying.
Oh, right. Okay.
Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard it in Chinese customs, but it definitely happens here in terms of when somebody's very ill. Often we had a lady on Hattie Ashton who talked about her mum was so elderly and so ill that they found they couldn't really give her the information.
Yeah.
So it, but it depends on the person and the family. But yeah, I do know of some people who are not told. But I didn't know it was a Chinese custom.
Yeah, I believe so. That sometimes the doctors won't tell them. They'll tell the family. And they'll all agree not to tell Nana what's happening. And
see, I find that really, I want to know. Okay. If anyone's listening, I want to know.
Yeah.
But I can understand, of course, some people, if you know someone, if you're a member of their family, you do know what's best for them or what's going to help them best. Yeah. And like Hattie was saying, you know, they knew it was just going to really frighten her.
Yeah.
And she didn't quite know where she was and she thought she was having a nice holiday. So.
Oh, well then, if I think I'm having a nice holiday, don't tell me.
Oh, I still want to be told.
Please. Really? You
yeah,
do?
I do.
Oh, no.
I want to know.
Well, this elderly...
I hate not knowing. Like, okay. In my life, I hate not knowing.
Well, this elderly lady who was in the care home... who didn't want to be there because she, and I knew she had said to me, because I'm embarrassed, it's going to be embarrassing and I don't want to be here. And then in her last day, I saw her on her last day and she was in her bed in a nappy and she told me that she, in her words, I shat myself this morning.
Fair enough.
But then she was also telling me that her son was coming with sausages.
Yeah.
You know, from the butcher shop. And that wasn't happening. But then we just had this long conversation about the barbecue and it was so wonderful.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, you don't need to know that you're here in this place that you desperately didn't want to be in.
Oh, no. Then I think, yeah, don't. Yeah. I'm not saying.
I wasn't going to drag her back from a holiday.
In her face. You are in a care home. Lady, wake up.
Yeah.
This is not where you want to be. No, don't wake me
up. Your son hasn't spoken to you in 30 years. Yeah. What are you talking about? Yeah. So that was nice. That was, again, a moment where
I
thought,
I guess you're right. Why not? Okay. Why not just drift away into, like, a little bit of delusion?
Drift away into the barbecue for a little while.
Oh, God. Actually, what am I talking about? Don't tell me. I want to stay in a barbecue. It sounds really nice. Imagine if there's no hope and you're already... It's difficult, especially, I guess, with elderly people that... When they do get, well, actually, with all ages, when they do start to get confused, and if you have told them and you have to tell them again.
Oh, God.
Have you had that? You
no.
Have to, oh, God, thank God.
No,
yeah.
I haven't. But, I mean, it's also so weird when you're just talking with people and they're vibrant and they're there and, isn't it? It's like you're going to vanish soon. I don't understand.
Do you stay for when they die, or is your job just to sort of take them... To be right up there until they die.
It depends on them and their family. And I guess before I got involved, I read an article about an organisation called No One Dies Alone. Have you heard of them?
No.
They're American. And they're specifically about that, about people who are alone. Right. And they will sit with them. But in our case, I haven't known of anyone yet who is completely alone.
Okay, yeah.
And I just follow the cues of the family. And sometimes towards the end, they do ask you to be there because you've become a very big part of this process.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've always sort of said, I tell you what, I'll just even wait outside. I'll go, you know, I'll be close. But
how do you feel when you're outside that room and you know the person you looked after is dying? And like, what's that like to be outside the room while that's happening?
It's, for me, it is just mind-boggling in a way that I'm sort of attracted to, if I'm honest. I think I'm trying to understand how can you vanish? How can people disappear? How can you be here and then not? And then, you know, you have those moments leading up where you think, if I hold on to you, will you not go? Like if I make you stay awake, will you not?
Yeah.
You know?
Did you
have that?
Yeah. And I think what I found as well since having a baby, and I always bang on about this on the podcast, but like...
It does change things.
It does.
Yeah.
It definitely changed my relationship to the deaths I dealt with because I now understand like that baby, you know, she came when she wanted to come. There was no... Even though I had every medical intervention possible because that she didn't want to come out. Like it feels very that... it's such a cliche, but how you enter and how you leave is a similar situation. There's not a lot of control the human beings can have about it. Even the person carrying the baby, you know, you can breathe and you can push them out, but
yeah,
when they're ready, they're ready.
Yeah.
Like, and
but we have so much medical intervention now at the time of death as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's become sort of abstract. I think 100 years ago, people did die in our houses. Our grandparents died there with us. We were all part of it. Now it's hidden. Now the medical profession treats it as a failure. They try and keep us alive for as long as possible, bring us back.
I know. I think especially, well, my mum said that when my dad had cancer and they gave him chemo, and she always says she wished they hadn't, because he was definitely too far gone and it made him so, so sick.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously with hindsight, you can say, oh, well, you know, if we hadn't done it, would we be, oh, we might have given him a couple more weeks. But she said she always found that really hard when she was like, why didn't they just say he's going?
Yeah.
It's too late. But like you said, I think that idea, it's always a failure, is interesting, because it's not always a failure. It's sometimes it's just...
Oh, it's never a failure. It's inevitable. Yeah, it's part of life. There's nothing we can do. You can eat clean. You can go to the gym. You can do whatever you want. Yeah. You're going to die.
Well, I think I've said this before as well, but my dad, you know, he was training to run an Ironman. Like, he ran triathlons and marathons. Like, he was so healthy that I think that's why it upset a lot of his friends, because they were like, oh, fuck. Mm-hmm. Like, he was really, that guy was the healthy one.
Yes.
I mean, he had not been healthy as a teenager and a 20-year-old.
Yeah, right.
But he was a very, yeah, so there's nothing you can do to stop this process. So why should it be viewed as a...
Yeah, I mean, our family is very healthy. We, despite our best efforts, we're just genetically blessed, particularly my father's side of the family. And now my sister has this really weird cancer.
Oh, wow.
And she's living with it at the moment, but 12 months ago... they didn't know what it was, and when they finally diagnosed it, it's some weird lung cancer that's so rare that they sent some of her tissue to America to study it. And
oh my goodness.
And I think we were all like, no, that doesn't happen to lorries.
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
We can drink and smoke and go hard balls to the wall for 70 years and still, you know. So, yeah, we do just take everything for granted. It's hard to understand we're going to die.
How do you feel when you're watching a patient struggle to stay alive then? When there is that medical intervention? Is there a part of you that wants to go, just take all this wire away, this person just needs to be left alone?
No, not for me. I mean, I'm just focused on their wishes and particularly, again, in old age care situation where so much choice is taken away from you.
Yeah.
I felt really lousy that one last thing that she asked for didn't happen. And also, you know, in Australia, we have a big euthanasia debate going on, and I always think of her and other people who have expressed to me a desire to have some control over that process and some dignity over that. And I think, you know, your choices just narrow, don't they? When you're terminally ill, everyone else is in control, in charge, telling you what you should be doing.
But that's why it reminds me so much of having a baby.
Yes, yeah.
Because that's what I was like, everyone's in charge, everyone's telling you what to do. You have the tiniest amount of control, really, which you have to fight for.
Yeah.
And you're doing that when, you know, hopefully you're fit and healthy and younger, and it's still so hard. I can't imagine how hard it is to be, you know, in your 80s or 90s and trying to be heard. Like, it must be so fucking frustrating.
Yeah, when people all kind of look at each other in your presence, when you say something, everyone kind of looks at each other like you're not making sense or you don't understand what's really going on.
Yeah. So do they often confide in you as a separate outside family member? I guess you're sort of a safe space to...
Yes, because my feelings won't be hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really hard to say to a family member,
leave
me alone. I want to die sooner. I'm sick of this. Yeah. Or it's hard to confess to a family member that you're terrified, because that scares them and upsets them. So, yeah, that first lady I used to see, who was my age, she eventually at the very end, she was the planner, and at the very end just got so scared.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But then she went into her, you know, medicated, confused state, which was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice. The last time I saw her, she was sitting in the courtyard of the hospital, and there are these feral rabbits that live in the courtyard, but because of the place it is, we all encourage them.
Yeah,
we feed them, and they're very sweet, and they come sort of at dusk. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's a beautiful garden, and then these bunnies come out of nowhere. And
that's so surreal.
I know, it really is.
It's like something out of a very strange, David Lynch version of the hospice film.
Yeah. And I remember we were all out there, her family and her two little children, and she was in a bed by that stage that they sort of jack up, so you're sort of sitting up, you know. She was confused, and her children were so small that they couldn't understand what was happening. But to them, it was just this great day where the bunnies came.
Yeah.
I remember thinking at the time, they are only noticing the great bits.
Yeah.
And so that was nice, and I thought she would be happy. I think that was the last time they saw her. I wish I could have told her that they thought it was magical.
Yeah. Oh, that's really hard.
Yeah.
That you couldn't let her know in some way.
Too late.
That's shitty.
It's shitty.
I find that really, because it's great that that happened. It's great that those children had that, but that's when I get angry with death, because I want there to be a moment we can just pause and let her know it's okay. Guess what? They had a nice time.
But I think we have to accept that, don't you think?
Yeah.
but don't you think that for our own lives, we have to accept, and we have to have peace in the fact that life goes on without us.
Yeah.
And our children will have magical moments without us.
Mm.
I think if I had one message for my children, it would be, you know, if I'm not around to support and love you, find someone who is.
Yeah.
That's the best you can hope for, and that's where happiness comes from, and that's where magic comes from. And
I wish you'd been around when I was 15.
Yeah.
I think that's why that story annoyed me, because I was like, because my dad died in the hospice. So I feel like whenever I hear that sort of children having to, you know, obviously I wasn't super, super young, I was 15.
Yeah.
But yeah, I still regress very much to a 15-year-old going, it's not fair. Like, and that's why I'm in therapy.
Yeah.
That's what I'm dealing with. Because and I've read about this, the children who are grieving as well, like you freeze in that moment.
Yeah.
So it's quite hard. You know, I'm eternally, my eternal self is kind of a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
And if you lost a parent when you're younger, you sort of freeze, because that's when everything made sense before that. You know, there was a moment it was clearer. But yeah, you're right. And I think the other thing it's important to realise is, go and find someone who loves you is a really brilliant expression, and it might not be who you want it to be. Like, it might not be family, it might not be the people you wish are going to replace that parent. Like, you know, you have to just find people who are going to love and support you. It can be anyone.
Yeah.
Just make sure they're good people.
Yeah, there are a lot of beautiful people in the world. Most people, actually.
Yeah.
And if you're open to them, they'll be open to you. But I hope that your dad, in some moment, had faith in your mum.
Oh,
and in
you, definitely.
That you would go on and you would have beauty in your life after this happened.
Yeah, and I think I was very lucky. As I said before, my mum was brilliant in that situation.
Yeah, great.
She was amazing. So I think there was I think it was more, I think, with my dad, he didn't want to die. I don't think he was, obviously he was worried about us, but it was more like he didn't want to die.
Yeah, and I get that.
Yeah. I think if it'd been the other way around, if it'd been my mum, I think my mum would have been worried about us.
I want to see where the iPhone ends up. You know, I want to see where this is all going.
iPhone 20 when it's in your face.
Yeah, I don't want to miss out on all of that, but I'll miss out on something. But now that you're talking about your age, that reminds me of my mother, whose mother killed herself when she was 9.
Oh, wow.
And that's so true. It's really interesting. Not that she's ever been, you know, immature, but she's really not very maternal.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard this as well. Like, it's very difficult to get past that moment. So, I mean, obviously this is cod psychology, but like, if she was 9, she never got into motherhood. And that's what I have definitely struggled with.
Yeah.
I still, in my head, I'm 15 a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I know how to react like a 15-year-old. And I still have to sometimes go, you're in your mid-30s.
Yeah.
You're 30. And it's really easy to work out how old I am. Because I always talk about how old I am. Anyway. And I have, that's what my, I've only had therapies for about a year, so I didn't have any at the time.
Wow.
And so much of it has been about going, okay, it's okay to let go of that 15-year-old. It's okay. Mm. But I think that's a moment when you're in such pain, you know, if your mum was 9, it's so much pain at that moment.
Yeah, and it happened in the house.
Oh, God.
She went to bed. And none of this, she told us, none of this as children.
Yeah.
I can't remember who, somebody, oh, she was very drunk one night. That's right. And she mentioned her parents something. And then I phoned my father the next day and I said, whoa, mum said this thing to me last night. And he said, so I was probably 30.
Wow.
And he said, oh, yeah, that did happen. And that's when I found out that she'd always said my mum died. And so what of? Oh, no, she just died. Yeah, as a result of, I guess, of that, mum is just not maternal. She's not very interested in looking after my twins. Certainly.
That is not helpful.
It's really not.
You could really do with the extra pair of hands.
But she lives in my garden. She lives in a granny flat in my garden. But she definitely has this feeling of being let down.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Constantly expecting to be let down.
Yeah, it really, I spent a lot of my time saying, oh, it's not going to define me. Mm. And now I am full up, hands up, it defines me. Of course it does. I don't know how, if I'd got married at 15, it would define me. You know, like if I'd won an Oscar at 15, it would define me. Like it's very easy, I think, sometimes with tragic situations to try and not run away with them, but control them.
Mm.
And I found it much, and this is just me, obviously everyone's different, I found it really helpful to be like, yeah, it's the biggest thing that ever happened to me. It totally defined me. It changed my personality. I still struggle with it. It's still something I'm working through. Why not? Why is that not? That's okay.
Yeah.
But obviously everyone's different. Some people are fine and they feel like they've dealt with their grief. And but I do think having, who are you?
I haven't met them.
I know, but sometimes, I don't know. My brother doesn't listen, so I can say. My brother finds it odd. He's like, oh, I just don't really think about it. And I'm always like, really?
How old was he?
He was 19.
Wow.
So they had, I think that jump is huge, actually, from 15 to 19. They had a very difficult relationship as well, but they had started kind of talking about it a bit, and he definitely had an adult relationship with him, which I 100% didn't. 100%. Yeah. I was still, that idiot my dad, you know. I'm still being a teenager. So yeah. I think that, yeah, it really does, you know, those childhood years. And then Julia in her book talks about if it happens when you're under 10, that is equally because you can only deal with it as a child. You don't really have understanding when it's your, so there's all these different phases of when it happens to you, of course. So,
and that's the great fear of having children, isn't it? I don't know if I ever thought of it before.
Yeah.
But suddenly when I had children, I felt this incredible pressure to live, to not make them the children whose mum dies one way or the other, to not kill myself, to not be in situations, you know, outlandish situations that I have been in before because I'm a traveller. I like to travel, and sometimes I put myself in these situations where I think, now, when everyone reads about this in the paper, they're going to say, what a stupid bitch. What was she expecting when she went away with these men she'd just met and they seemed like nice fellows and they wanted to show her something. So now I feel this responsibility to be more cautious in my life, not make them those children.
And that's funny because I had such a death so young, I am the most cautious. I have been cautious since I was 15. Like at 15, I was like, we cannot fuck around anymore. Like I was like, my friends would take drugs and I was like, no, I can't because we might die, guys. And they'd be like, you're bumming out the party. I was like, I know.
Yeah, I never got that till I had kids.
Yeah, see, but that's the right inverted commas, the normal, the easy, the healthier, funner way to do it. I don't know. It's the way it is. But yeah, I do think that's what, I go in again, inverted commas, the perfect life way is that you shouldn't until your kids be aware of your own mortality. That's lovely. But I think when you lose a parent younger, like, And my friends who've lost parents, like, I have a friend from school who also lost her dad, Hannah, and we are very close because of this. And we completely, like, if the phone goes, we're like, who died?
Oh, yes.
Who died? What happened? Who's dead? I'm preparing myself. I'm ready. And they're like, oh, no, I was just calling out the blue. Do not do that. Text me beforehand.
We have that after 9 p.m. For some reason, my mum decided everyone dies after 9 p.m. So if the phone rings after 9 p.m., she thinks someone's dead.
And probably because what happened to her, she went to bed.
Yes,
so
you're right. So, oh, my God.
So now that you get that fear of, like, you can't quite trust.
I just got a chill when you said that. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
You make up a little rule. And because you're a child, you make up a crazy rule, you know, because you're like, well, the world doesn't make sense. Everything's gone. So how can I apply some logic to it? Okay. So my new logic is like, no one is safe unless I'm looking at them, unless I can find them.
And actually, my grandfather died overnight too. I remember waking up in the morning. He'd been in and out of hospital a lot. And now looking back, he'd had a lot of those moments of dysphoria and all of that. And but I wasn't really expecting him to die, even though people kept saying to me, he might.
Yeah.
I didn't really. And I remember waking up and my grandmother was there and she hadn't been there the night before.
Right.
And she came and sat on my bed and my father sat next to her. And then I knew he was gone. And you're right, that was overnight. But also the suicide thing, I'm really glad I didn't find out until I was older because I was quite suicidal as a youngster.
Wow.
And I feel like had I known that, I would have thought, oh, well, that's why.
Yeah.
And it's my destiny.
Yeah, it's interesting,
isn't
it?
You know, I've inherited that from my grandmother. Whereas later I thought, oh, I'm glad I'm only finding this out now. And then later I had children and thought, oh, well, now I can't. which was funny because it was a bit of a bummer, actually. I suddenly thought, oh.
That's that option gone?
Yeah, the control of that is gone.
That's how I felt at 15, because I was also like, I mean, I was suicidal in that teenage way.
Yeah.
I definitely felt like, oh, well, that option's gone.
Yeah.
I can't do anything dramatic now, can I? Because now I know what it does to everybody.
Yeah.
So now I see, you know, you can see the after effects, almost like surviving an earthquake or something. So you're like, well, now I can't. Well, now I can't do anything stupid.
Oh, no.
I'm going to behave myself. But then other people go the other way. I know plenty of people who, you know, go through an early death and they go, great, they go full on, I'm going to do everything because I can't control it. So, yeah, it doesn't guarantee you.
No, it doesn't.
An uptight teenager, guys.
No, it doesn't. And so, now that I'm so focused on Buddhism, you know, Buddhism's kind of obsessed with death. So,
yeah. When did that happen? So you are now, you're a Buddhist, but you weren't raised a Buddhist.
No, I was raised Catholic.
So when did Catholicism lose you?
Very early on.
Fair
and,
enough.
You know, a big part of Catholicism for me certainly was my mum telling me that all the dead relatives were watching me all the time.
Oh, we've talked about this. It's the worst. Why? I don't want to be watched.
Isn't it horrible?
It's so horrible. Especially a teenager, when I'm doing everything?
Right.
I am more than kissing this boy.
I am kissing people. I'm masturbating. Yeah. I'm doing all sorts. And my great aunt Greta is watching me.
Because if she was alive, I definitely wouldn't do this in front of her.
No, and
I'd be polite.
She wouldn't want me to. And
I would leave the room.
Yeah, and she'd leave the room. So why would she not leave the room in heaven? Yeah, so
that's what they do. Just excuse me a second. Michelle is doing something very awful. I'm just going to go next door. That's heaven's just very polite.
No, I would think so.
I'd hope so, yeah.
So, yeah, that all annoyed me. And then, I don't know, I just turned on religion for a while and then found my way back to Buddhism. I was very depressed and, suffering that suicidal depression again in my early 30s and just couldn't get out of it and thought, I'll give this a serious go because I hadn't before. And I went to a Buddhist center and the first class I saw was dealing with disturbing emotions. And I thought, that's me.
I'm home.
And it was really very helpful. And yes, their fascination with death was a surprise to me. I didn't know that.
Yeah, see, I know a tiny bit about Buddhism.
Yeah.
But not enough. So what are they, what's their take on it?
Well, you know, it's a big take. There's lots to unpack. There's, you know, reincarnation.
Yeah.
And that idea, I keep saying, you know, how do people vanish when they die?
Yeah.
And they're sort of saying, well, they don't. That's impossible. Clearly that energy and that stream that continues, it can't vanish. And the idea of facing death is very important to them, of not running away from it. We're taught to meditate on death, would you believe?
Yeah. I have done Buddhist meditation.
Yeah.
And I did find the death meditation a bit much.
It's a lot.
Well, I found it hard to do, definitely. Yeah.
But I liked that because, I wanted to walk up to death.
Yeah.
And I liked that they were saying, yes, you should do that every day. You should walk up to death and understand that it's there and put the rest of your life into that context.
It's interesting because when I first started doing this podcast, I didn't really think about what would happen. You know, I just thought, I'll just chat to some people. And then I carried on doing it. And about, I guess, sort of midway through, I was like, this is really hard. I'm having to talk about my dad's death all the time. And my husband even said to me, he was like, do you think you should stop? Like, is this mentally good for you? And I was like, this is not good for me. Like, I am struggling. And then I pushed on through and we kept doing it. And I can't believe I've got so much more at peace with his death and my death from talking about it. And it's hard to say that sometimes because it sounds like it doesn't make sense, but it's just like you said, because you're so aware of death all the time, and maybe you have this with your palliative care. When I hear about something, I'm not as like, I might feel sad for someone, but I don't get that like, oh God, someone died. I'm like, yes, of course they did.
Yeah.
And that's really, I never used to feel like that. I used to feel like sick and anxious the moment death was mentioned.
You have become an excellent Buddhist. Yes, you really have.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I did love my Buddhist meditation classes.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I did.
But absolutely. And I think...
I kept falling asleep. That was the trouble.
That's fine.
They
a lot of people
so
do.
So good.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
Oh, really nice sleeps.
I've heard of a monk whose teacher made him sit on the side of a well to meditate to stop him falling asleep. Otherwise he'd fall in.
Yeah, it was so nice.
Yes, it's very common. But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think walking up to death death and including death in the context of your life is a positive thing. It can only be a positive. Yeah. It can only make you value everything and everyone around you and every day more.
I think it's hard because obviously it's sad, and obviously it depends on your relationship and what's happened to you. Obviously some people have had terrible things and you don't want it in your face, but just to keep it present, it does make you appreciate things. It's such a cliche, but of course it does, because if you're constantly reminded this is all going to go.
Yeah.
Jesus, am I a Buddhist? I didn't even know.
I think you actually are. I think you really
are. My dad would be so proud. He would be so proud. He's very into all of that.
Yeah, we're all Buddhists in the end.
Yeah. Well, it's handy, isn't it? Because it's like, come on, if you're going to choose one that makes you come back.
Yeah.
But come back is like a different, well, I can be a dog. Yes, okay.
Here's the funny thing about Buddhism, though. The ultimate success in Buddhism is not coming back. Isn't that funny? So again, it's this topsy-turvy perspective from the one that I was raised with, this Anglo-Christian perspective. The idea of not having to come back. This is why His Holiness the Dalai Lama is so revered, because he reached enlightenment many years ago and he chooses to come back to be compassionate and keep helping people.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. He's not a reincarnation of Buddha. He's a reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. So this is why people love him so much.
Have you met him?
I have, a couple of times, yes.
Wow, what was that like?
He's very pragmatic. That's why I love him so much. He's we do gigs together when he's in Australia.
Has he got a good tight five?
He really does. And you know, after a few visits, the organisers started saying to me, "You're our favourite person to sit with His Holiness on stage because you never interrupt him." And I say, "That's because I emceed a lot of comedy gigs."
Yeah.
And I kind of know when he's finished and when he's not. And also over time, I've learnt about some of his favourite gear. So sometimes I'll lead him into his favourite bits of gear. Yeah, I'll go, hey.
By gear, you mean material.
Material, that's sometimes, what we call in Australia,
sometimes
sorry.
Sometimes gear can be drugs.
Oh, yeah, no, sorry.
So I was like, whoa, you're dealing the Dalai Lama.
No, in Australia, we call that's drugs,
material.
But it's also material.
Okay,
all
right.
Yeah, rope, do you call it ever rope?
Oh,
old rope.
Yeah, old rope, yeah.
So, yeah, particularly if he's tired, I'll think to myself, all right, let's throw him a bone and let's get him to tell everyone about.
Michelle, what you're saying is you're in a double act for the Dalai Lama.
Sometimes, and it's wonderful.
That's incredible.
Yeah, he's very funny. He's very pragmatic. But, you know, some previous Dalai Lamas didn't really want to be the Dalai Lama.
I've heard there was one who didn't, was like a naughty Dalai Lama.
Yeah. He was boozing and womanizing.
Yeah, he's like, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, but luckily this guy's really into it. And there's a great story about death that I always talk about of his, an anecdote about people coming to visit him in India, where you can. Certainly Tibetan people can go and visit with him. And an elderly man came to him and said, I'm dying. Can you, I don't know, do what you do, cast a spell, do what you do. And His Holiness said, well, I can't cast any spells. What I can do is get at my doctors to give you, you know, to come and see you. And he said, I hope that helps and I hope you don't die. But if you do die, don't forget to die gently.
Oh, that's really nice.
It's really nice. And I think about that a lot. And that's my aim, is to die gently.
That's really nice. Because that's, as I say, I don't think my dad did die gently. He's very struggled with that, definitely. Mm. My mum 100% helped him to die gently, because he was definitely, I mean, he was 44, so I can, you know, it's
hard.
It's hard to, but that is a really lovely phrase. And weirdly, again, it reminds me, I did hypnobirthing. I mean, I ended up with a cesarean, guys, so it didn't really, I did everything. But in hypnobirthing, the big thing is to like give birth gently, to be calm and to control your breathing and try and I think some of hypnobirthing is, obviously, if you need intervention, which is what happened to me, it's amazing. But it really helped me to try and give birth as gently as I could in what is, you know, is really frightening.
Yes.
Really, really scary. And something's happened to you completely out of control of. And it's...
And you're right. It's very similar to the death process, isn't it?
Yeah. I couldn't believe how similar it was until... And I hate saying it because I feel like if you haven't had children or can't have children or don't want to have children, that doesn't mean you don't understand life.
No.
Of course. I'm just coming from
own birth. I mean, again, in Buddhism, they talk about our own births as being very similar to the death process.
You know,
to coming, this contracting, this squeezing, pushing, pulling, this pushing through into this bright light, the screaming, the, I mean, can you imagine what's going through our little tiny minds?
I know. It must be so terrifying. And that's why it's terrifying at the end. It's a terrifying thing. But it, like you said, that's the job on earth, is to try and process that.
And at the very least, I think, did your believing that you were going to have a gentle birth help you in the lead up?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yes. Because I was like really annoying. I was like, we're doing hypnobirthing, so I'm going to have like a perfect birth. I'm going to like breathe my way through it, water birth. And I did not, I mean, I literally, from induction to cesarean, I had every single medical intervention because so many things went wrong.
Yeah.
But I always, somebody says to me, oh, well, there you go, hypnobirthing's a load of crap. And I was like, no. Like, I got through that cesarean because I was still doing the same breathing as if I was in a water birth.
And you got through that last month of pregnancy, which is also terrifying.
Oh, my God,
because you believed you were going to have a gentle birth.
Yeah, and it really did soothe all my, because I was like, I found the magic spell.
Yeah.
I found the magic spell. I just have to breathe and it won't hurt.
Yeah.
Why is no one else doing this?
So I believe I am going to have a gentle death.
Yeah.
And so today, that makes me feel good.
Yeah, that's true. You that's know, very true.
Confident.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a weird thing to think. Do you ever think about your ideal death?
I because of what happened to me, I just want to get old. I have this thing now of like, I just, and especially since having a child, I don't want her to have to go, or when she does, I want her to be old enough for it not to be a tragedy.
Yeah.
That's basically all I cling to, is that when I do die, people go, oh, they don't go, oh, fuck.
Yeah,
which is what happened to me, which I think is very common if you've lost. You just want them, like you said, not to be the girl who's died.
Yeah,
but in terms of death, I think me and my mum always say like, God, if you just have a nice kip, go to bed, cup of tea, and then that's it. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Gentle. Yeah.
One of my old aunties, Auntie Muriel, she was the potty one, and so she was the one I loved visiting. She lived on chocolate biscuits, and she had, her entire house was full of ornaments and trinkets, like stuffed parrots hanging in the doorways and everything. And when she died, she just wasn't answering the phone one morning to her sister. Her sister sent her son around. He went in, and there she was sitting up in her bed with her glasses on her nose.
Oh, my God.
And a book in her lap.
Auntie Muriel did it right. She did it right.
High five.
Yeah, like that's that's a gentle death.
She was a gentle lady, and she lived in a sort of a beautiful fantasy world of her own, and everyone else tut-tutted about her and her out-of-date chocolate biscuits, but, you know, she did it her way. And she gave zero fucks, I believe.
Yeah.
Well before it was a hashtag.
That's all you can do.
Yeah.
So you've written this book about Buddhism.
I've written two books about Buddhism.
Wow.
Buddhism for Breakups and Buddhism for the Unbelievably Busy.
Oh, wow.
And both of them, I think, very much have the context of death in terms of I'm 44. The first 40 years went so fast.
Yeah.
I look at my parents now who are only 23 years older than me.
Yeah.
And I think, well, I need to make sure that as much as possible I'm living this beautiful life that I'm so lucky to have.
Mm.
And that's another part of Buddhism, is really connecting with the luck of being born human.
Yeah.
For a start.
Even though I want to come back as a dog.
I know. But you know what? The trouble with being a dog is you don't have any control over your spirituality. This is the Buddhist teaching.
I see. Okay. All right.
And you could be born a dog in a country that doesn't like dogs.
No, I want to be born in England.
Of course.
That's where we love the
dogs.
You
want to be my dog who
exactly.
sleeps in the bed with me, and you want to be Big Jacko. That's my dog. When you come from a place of feeling lucky all the time, as I do in Buddhism, and definitely lucky to have this beautiful life, walking here today in London, remember yesterday the weather was terrible.
Oh, my God, and it's so beautiful today. It's really
so
sunny.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And so to notice that, and to take the time to look up and see it and think about it and take a photo and Instagram it and just think, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm in London talking about my books and things. And, you know, that this is a life that I am living and putting together here.
Yeah.
You know, and when it's over, it will have been a nice one.
That's all you can do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is try and live gently, perhaps, whatever that means to you.
Yeah.
In some way.
And have my children be able to go, wow. Even if, God forbid, touch wood, it is early enough to feel tragic, even then they can say, wow, look what she did. She wrote books. She travelled. She, you know.
And that, I mean,
life is magical.
That's definitely how I feel about my dad.
Yes.
Even though it was obviously tragic, the process of accepting it, there's still moments where I'm like, oh, he lived a great life and he was, you know, did all these crazy things. He very much lived exactly how he wanted to do.
Wonderful. He was 44?
Yeah, he was 44. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when you go back to Australia, are you going back to palliative care?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm between patients at the moment because the last one was my lady in the retirement home.
Right.
And she lived a lot longer than we expected. So I ended up...
Were you like, whoa, this client is hanging on.
She's hanging in there. And I loved that.
Yeah.
And but we became quite close. And so I thought, oh, I actually really do need a break after this one. I really miss her.
How long were you looking after her for?
About 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Of weekly visits. And as much as I say I was trained not to problem solve, she did. She had no family there.
Right.
And she did love it when I get a bit involved and drive her around to her medical appointments and things like that. And so, yeah, it was a big loss. So I'm having a little break, but back on deck when I go home. So who knows? I mean, I'll get a phone call one day and they'll say, I've got this person for you. This is their story. And next minute I'll be in their home. And
that's amazing.
We'll be talking about their bowel movements.
Which, like when you've had a baby, when someone's dying, you talk a lot about their bowel movements.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah. And I understand.
How they get to the toilet, what did they do? How are we going to get them out the toilet?
The medication, the Celexa makes you go to the toilet, but the morphine sometimes.
Oh, can block you up.
Can block you up. So suddenly I'm an expert on this morphine Celexa nexus. You know, it's amazing.
That is amazing. And if people in Australia want to do what you do, is it you can just volunteer?
Yes.
What's the name of the service?
I would Google it. For me, I actually volunteer for a Catholic service, right. Mercy Palliative Care.
And they're cool with a Buddhist doing this.
Absolutely cool.
Good on them. Good on
them. Yeah, they're beautiful, beautiful women who run it. It's mostly women who volunteer. Mm. And so just Google it. There'll be someone somewhere if you want to do it. And it's really rewarding and it's not that morbid. Normally, this person looks to you for like, fantastic, here's my visitor.
Yeah.
We can talk about anything. We'll talk about memories. We'll talk about TV. We'll talk about, it's not that morbid. It's a lot of laughs and.
Yeah, you're not the doctor delivering any bad news. You're just someone who's chosen to spend some time with them.
Then. Yeah. And you're not the family who's sort of a bit tired and sick of it all. And you're a fresh face who blows in once a week and. And it's nice. And you're right. With the elderly, it's easier and, you know, it's nice.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
Thank you.
And thank you for doing that.
Thank you for your podcast. I think it's really, I enjoy it so much.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Your beautiful voice and listening to people share their stories. I just listened to this morning to the lady from Game of Thrones.
Oh, Gemma. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I mean, so detailed and.
And what a gentle death.
Beautiful, gentle death and beautiful, generous conversation from her. Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can follow Michelle on Twitter at Michelle_Laurie, and Michelle is spelled M-E-S-H-A-L. And you can buy her new book, Buddhism for the Unbelievably Busy, and also Buddhism for Breakups at all very good bookstores now. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked the show, please do rate and review. If you liked it, 5 stars worth. That's probably definitely worth letting iTunes know about. That's my computer making a noise. It's so, so appreciated. And that's my baby in the background. I'm recording this under a duvet, guys. It's not easy. Oh, she's crying. Okay, listen, I'll be quick. You can follow us on Twitter at TheGriefCast or on Instagram or email thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was composed by the Glue Ensemble and the show was produced by Kate Holland. As ever, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.